This is Audible.
Listening Library presents Fallen by Lauren Kate, read for you by Justine Eyre. But paradise is locked and bolted. We must make a journey around the world to see if a back door has perhaps been left open. Heinrich von Kleist, On the Puppet Theater. In the Beginning. Helston, England, September 1854. Around midnight, her eyes at last took shape. The look in them was feline, half determined and half tentative, all trouble. Yes, they were just right, those eyes, rising up to her fine, elegant brow, inches from the dark cascade of her hair. He held the paper at arm's length to assess his progress. It was hard, working without her in front of him, but then he never could sketch in her presence. Since he had arrived from London, no, since he had first seen her, he'd had to be careful always to keep her at a distance. Every day now she approached him, and every day was more difficult than the one before. It was why he was leaving in the morning, for India, for the Americas, he didn't know or care. Wherever he ended up, it would be easier than being here. He leaned over the drawing again, sighing as he used his thumb to perfect the smudged charcoal pout of her full bottom lip. This lifeless paper, cruel impostor, was the only way to take her with him. Then, straightening up in the leather library chair, he felt it. That brush of warmth on the back of his neck. Her. Her mere proximity gave him the most peculiar sensation, like the kind of heat sent out when a log shatters to ash in a fire. He knew, without turning around, she was there. He covered her likeness on the bound papers in his lap, but he could not escape her. His eyes fell on the ivory-upholstered settee across the parlor, where only hours earlier she turned up unexpectedly, later than the rest of her party, in a rose silk gown, to applaud the eldest daughter of their host after a fine turn at the harpsichord. He glanced across the room, out the window to the veranda, where the day before she'd crept up on him, a fistful of wild white peonies in her hand. She still thought the pull she felt toward him was innocent, that their frequent rendezvous in the gazebo were merely happy coincidences. To be so naive, he would never tell her otherwise. The secret was his to bear. He stood and turned, the sketches left behind on the leather chair. And there she was, pressed against the ruby velvet curtain in her plain white dressing gown. Her black hair had fallen from its braid. The look on her face was the same as the one he'd sketched so many times. There was the fire rising in her cheeks. Was she angry? Embarrassed? He longed to know, but could not allow himself to ask. "What are you doing here?" He could hear the snarl in his voice and regretted its sharpness, knowing she would never understand.
I couldn't sleep," she stammered, moving toward the fire and his chair.
"I saw the light in your room, and then..." She paused, looking down at her hands. "Your trunk outside the door. Are you going somewhere?"
"I was going to tell you."
He broke off. He shouldn't lie. He had never intended to let her know his plans. Telling her would only make things worse. Already he had let things go too far, hoping this time would be different. She drew nearer, and her eyes fell on his sketchbook.
"You were drawing me?"
Her startled tone reminded him how great the gap was in their understanding. Even after all the time they'd spent together these past few weeks, she had not yet begun to glimpse the truth that lay behind their attraction. This was good, or at least it was for the better. For the past several days, since he'd made the choice to leave, he'd been struggling to pull away from her. The effort took so much out of him that as soon as he was alone, he had to give in to his pent-up desire to draw her. He had filled up his book with pages of her arched neck, her marble collarbone, the black abyss of her hair. Now, he looked back at the sketch, not ashamed at being caught drawing her, but worse, A cold chill spread through him as he realized that her discovery, the exposure of his feelings, would destroy her. He should have been more careful. It always began like this. "Warm milk with a spoonful of treacle," he murmured, his back still to her. Then he added sadly, "It helps you sleep."
"How did you know?" "Why, that's exactly what my mother used to."
"I know," he said, turning to face her.
The astonishment in her voice did not surprise him, yet he could not explain to her how he knew, or tell her how many times he had administered this very drink to her in the past, when the shadows came, how he had held her until she fell asleep.
He felt her touch as though it were burning through his shirt, her hand laid gently on his shoulder, causing him to gasp. They had not yet touched in this life, and the first contact always left him breathless.
"Answer me," she whispered. "Are you leaving?"
"Yes."
"Then take me with you," she blurted out. Right on cue, he watched her suck in her breath, wishing to take back her plea. He could see the progression of her emotions settle in the crease between her eyes. She would feel impetuous, then bewildered, then ashamed by her own forwardness. She always did this, and too many times before he had made the mistake of comforting her at this exact moment.
"No," he whispered, remembering, always remembering. "I sail tomorrow. If you care for me at all, you won't say another word."
"If I care for you," she repeated, almost as if she were speaking to herself. I love...
"Don't."
"I have to say it. I love you, I'm quite sure, and if you leave..."
"If I leave, I save your life."
He spoke slowly, trying to reach a part of her that might remember. Was it there at all, buried somewhere?
"Some things are more important than love. You won't understand, but you have to trust me."
Her eyes drilled into him. She stepped back and crossed her arms over her chest. This was his fault, too. He always brought out her contemptuous side when he spoke down to her. "You mean to say there are things more important than this?" she challenged, taking his hands and drawing them to her heart. Oh, to be her and not know what was coming, or at least to be stronger than he was and be able to stop her. If he didn't stop her, she would never learn, and the past would only repeat itself, torturing them both again and again. The familiar warmth of her skin under his hands made him tilt his head back and moan. He was trying to ignore how close she was, how well he knew the feel of her lips on his, how bitter he felt that all of this had to end. But her fingers traced his so lightly. He could feel her heart racing through her thin cotton gown. She was right. There was nothing more than this. There never was. He was about to give in and take her in his arms when he caught the look in her eyes, as if she'd seen a ghost. She was the one to pull away, a hand to her forehead. "I'm having the strangest sensation," she whispered. No, was it already too late? Her eyes narrowed into the shape in his sketch, and she came back to him, her hands on his chest, her lips parted expectantly. "Tell me I'm mad, but I swear I've been right here before." So it was too late. He looked up, shivering, and could feel the dark descending. He took one last chance to seize her, to hold her as tightly as he'd been yearning to for weeks. As soon as her lips melted into his, both of them were powerless. The honeysuckle taste of her mouth made him dizzy. The closer she pressed against him, the more his stomach churned with the thrill and the agony of it all. Her tongue traced his, and the fire between them burned brighter, hotter, more powerful with every new touch, every new exploration. Yet none of it was new. The room quaked. An aura around them started to glow. She noticed nothing, was aware of nothing, understood nothing besides their kiss. He alone knew what was about to happen, what dark companions were prepared to fall on their reunion.
Even though he was unable to alter the course of their lives yet again, he knew. The shadows swirled directly overhead. So close he might have touched them. So close he wondered whether she could hear what they were whispering. He watched as the cloud passed over her face. For a moment he saw a spark of recognition growing in her eyes. Then there was nothing. Nothing at all. 1. Perfect Strangers. Luce barged into the fluorescent-lit lobby of the Sword and Cross School 10 minutes later than she should have. A barrel-chested attendant with ruddy cheeks and a clipboard clamped under an iron bicep was already giving orders, which meant Luce was already behind. "So remember, it's meds, beds, and reds," the attendant barked at a cluster of 3 other students, all standing with their backs to Luce. "Remember the basics, and no one gets hurt." Luce hurried to slip in behind the group. She was still trying to figure out whether she'd filled out the giant stack of paperwork correctly, whether this shaven-headed guide standing before them was a man or a woman, whether there was anyone to help her with this enormous duffel bag, whether her parents were going to get rid of her beloved Plymouth Fury the minute they arrived home from dropping her off here. They'd been threatening to sell the car all summer, and now they had a reason even Luce couldn't argue with. No one was allowed to have a car at Luce's new school. Her new reform school, to be precise. She was still getting used to the term. Could you repeat that? She asked the attendant. What was it, meds? Well, look what the storm blew in, the attendant said loudly, then continued, enunciating slowly. Meds. If you're one of the medicated students, this is where you go to keep yourself doped up. Sane, breathing, whatever. Woman, Luce decided, studying the attendant. No man would be catty enough to say all that in such a saccharine tone of voice. Got it. Luce felt her stomach heave. Meds. She'd been off meds for years now. After the accident this past summer, Dr. Sanford, her specialist in Hopkinton, and the reason her parents had sent her to boarding school all the way in New Hampshire, had wanted to consider medicating her again. Though she'd finally convinced him of her quasi-stability, it had taken an extra month of analysis on her part just to stay off those awful antipsychotics. Which was why she was enrolling in her senior year at Sword and Cross a full month after the academic year had begun. Being a new student was bad enough, and Luce had been really nervous about having to jump into classes where everyone else was already settled. But from the looks of this tour, she wasn't the only new kid arriving today. She sneaked a peek at the 3 other students standing in a half circle around her. At her last school, Dover Prep, the campus tour on the first day was where she'd met her best friend, Callie. On a campus where all the other students had practically been weaned together, it would have been enough that Luce and Callie were the only non-legacy kids. But it didn't take long for the 2 girls to realize they also had the exact same obsession with the exact same old movies, especially where Albert Finney was concerned. After their discovery freshman year, while watching 2 for the Road, that neither one of them could make a bag of popcorn without setting off the fire alarm, Callie and Luce hadn't left each other's sides. Until they'd had to. At Luce's sides today were 2 boys and a girl. The girl seemed easy enough to figure out, blonde and Neutrogena commercial pretty, with pastel pink manicured nails that matched her plastic binder. "I'm Gabby," she drawled, flashing Luce a big smile that disappeared as quickly as it had surfaced, before Luce could even offer her own name. The girl's waning interest reminded her more of a southern version of the girls at Dover than someone she'd expect at Sword and Cross. Luce couldn't decide whether this was comforting or not, any more than she could imagine what a girl who looked like this would be doing at reform school. To Luce's right was a guy with short brown hair, brown eyes, and a smattering of freckles across his nose. But the way he wouldn't even meet her eyes, just kept picking at a hangnail on his thumb, gave Luce the impression that, like her, he was probably still stunned and embarrassed to find himself here. The guy to her left, on the other hand, fit Luce's image of this place a little bit too perfectly. He was tall and thin, with a DJ bag slung over his shoulder, shaggy black hair, and large, deep-set green eyes. His lips were full, and a natural rose color most girls would kill for. At the back of his neck, a black tattoo in the shape of a sunburst seemed almost to glow on his light skin, rising up from the edge of his black T-shirt. Unlike the other two, when this guy turned to meet her gaze, he held it and didn't let go. His mouth was set in a straight line, but his eyes were warm and alive. He gazed at her, standing as still as a sculpture, which made Luce feel rooted to her spot, too. She sucked in her breath. Those eyes were intense and alluring and, well, a little bit disarming. With some loud throat-clearing noises, the attendant interrupted the boy's trance-like stare. Luce blushed and pretended to be very busy scratching her head. "Those of you who've learned the ropes are free to go after you dump your hazards." The attendant gestured at a large cardboard box under a sign that said in big black letters, "Prohibited Materials." "And when I say free, Todd..." She clamped a hand down on the freckled kid's shoulder, making him jump. "I mean gymnasium-bound to meet your pre-assigned student guides. You," she pointed at Luce, "dump your hazards and stay with me." The four of them shuffled toward the box, and Luce watched, baffled, as the other students began to empty their pockets. The girl pulled out a 3-inch pink Swiss Army knife. The green-eyed guy reluctantly dumped a can of spray paint and a box cutter. Even the hapless Todd let loose several books of matches and a small container of lighter fluid. Luce felt almost stupid that she wasn't concealing a hazard of her own, but when she saw the other kids reach into their pockets and chuck their cell phones into the box, she gulped. Leaning forward to read the "Prohibited Materials" sign a little more closely, she saw that cell phones, pagers, and all two-way radio devices were strictly forbidden. It was bad enough that she couldn't have her car. Luce clamped a sweaty hand around the cell phone in her pocket, her only connection to the outside world. When the attendant saw the look on her face, Luce received a few quick slaps on the cheek. "Don't swoon on me, kid. They don't pay me enough to resuscitate. Besides, you get one phone call once a week in the main lobby." One phone call? Once a week? But... She looked down at her phone one last time and saw that she'd received two new text messages. It didn't seem possible that these would be her two last text messages. The first one was from Callie. "Call immediately. We'll be waiting by the phone all night, so be ready to dish. And remember the mantra I assigned you. You'll survive. BTW, for what it's worth, I think everyone's totally forgotten about..." In typical Callie fashion, she'd gone on so long that Luce's crap cell phone cut the message off 4 lines in. In a way, Luce was almost relieved. She didn't want to read about how everyone from her old school had already forgotten what had happened to her, what she'd done to land herself in this place. She sighed and scrolled down to her second message. It was from her mom, who'd only just gotten the hang of texting a few weeks ago, and who surely had not known about this one-call-once-a-week thing, or she would never have abandoned her daughter here. Right? "Kiddo, we are always thinking of you. Be good and try to eat enough protein. We'll talk when we can. Love, M and D." With a sigh, Luce realized her parents must have known. How else to explain their drawn faces when she'd waved goodbye at the school gates this morning, duffel bag in hand? At breakfast, she tried to joke about finally losing that appalling New England accent she'd picked up at Dover, but her parents hadn't even cracked a smile. She'd thought they were still mad at her. They never did the whole raising their voice thing, which meant that when Luce really messed up, they just gave her the old silent treatment. Now she understood this morning's strange demeanor. Her parents were already mourning the loss of contact with their only daughter. "We're still waiting on one person," the attendant sang. "I wonder who it is."
Lucy's attention snapped back to the hazard box, which was now brimming with contraband she didn't even recognize. She could feel the dark-haired boy's green eyes staring at her. She looked up and noticed that everyone was staring. Her turn. She closed her eyes and slowly opened her fingers, letting her phone slip from her grasp and land with a sad thunk on top of the heap. The sound of being all alone. Todd and the fembot Gabby headed for the door without so much as a look in Luce's direction, but the third boy turned to the attendant.
"I can fill her in," he said, nodding at Luce.
"Not part of our deal," the attendant replied automatically, as if she'd been expecting this dialogue. "You're a new student again. That means new student restrictions. Back to square one. You don't like it? You should have thought twice before breaking parole."
The boy stood motionless, expressionless, as the attendant tugged Luce, who'd stiffened at the word parole, toward the end of a yellowed hall.
"Moving on," she said, as if nothing had just happened. "Beds."
She pointed out the west-facing window to a distant cinder-block building. Luce could see Gabby and Todd shuffling slowly toward them, with the third boy walking slowly, as if catching up to them were the last thing on his list of things to do. The dorm was formidable and square, a solid gray block of a building whose thick double doors gave away nothing about the possibility of life inside them. A large stone plaque stood planted in the middle of the dead lawn, and Luce remembered from the website the words "Pauline Dormitory" chiseled into it. It looked even uglier in the hazy morning sun than it had looked in the flat black-and-white photograph. Even from this distance, Luce could see black mold covering the face of the dorm. All the windows were obstructed by rows of thick steel bars. She squinted. Was that barbed wire topping the fence around the building? The attendant looked down at a chart, flipping through Luce's file.
"Room 63. Throw your bag in my office with the rest of them for now. You can unpack this afternoon."
Luce dragged her red duffel bag toward three other nondescript black trunks. Then she reached reflexively for her cell phone, where she usually keyed in things she needed to remember. But as her hand searched her empty pocket, she sighed and committed the room number to memory instead. She still didn't see why she couldn't just stay with her parents. Their house in Thunderbolt was less than a half hour from Sword and Cross. It had felt so good to be back home in Savannah, where, as her mom always said, even the wind blew lazily. Georgia's softer, slower pace suited Luce way more than New England ever had. But Sword and Cross didn't feel like Savannah. It hardly felt like anywhere at all, except the lifeless, colorless place where the court had mandated she board. She'd overheard her dad on the phone with the headmaster the other day, nodding in his befuddled biology professor way and saying, "Yes, yes, maybe it would be best for her to be supervised all the time. No, no, we wouldn't want to interfere with your system." Clearly, her father had not seen the conditions of his only daughter's supervision. This place looked like a maximum security prison.
"And what about, what did you say, the Reds?" Luce asked the attendant, ready to be released from the tour.
"Reds," the attendant said, pointing toward a small, wired device hanging from the ceiling, a lens with a flashing red light. Luce hadn't seen it before, but as soon as the attendant pointed the first one out, she realized they were everywhere.
"Cameras?"
"Very good," the attendant said, voice dripping condescension. "We make them obvious in order to remind you. All the time, everywhere, we're watching you. So don't screw up. That is, if you can help yourself." Every time someone talked to Luce like she was a total psychopath, she came that much closer to believing it was true. All summer, the memories had haunted her, in her dreams and in the rare moments her parents left her alone. Something had happened in that cabin, and everyone, including Luce, was dying to know exactly what. The police,
the judge, the social worker, had all tried to pry the truth out of her, but she was as clueless about it all as they were. She and Trevor had been joking around the whole evening, chasing each other down to the row of cabins on the lake, away from the rest of the party. She tried to explain that it had been one of the best nights of her life, until it turned into the worst. She'd spent so much time replaying that night in her head, hearing Trevor's laugh, feeling his hands close around her waist, and trying to reconcile her gut instinct that she really was innocent. But now, every rule and regulation at Sword and Cross seemed to work against that notion, seemed to suggest that she was, in fact, dangerous and needed to be controlled. Luce felt a firm hand on her shoulder. "Look," the attendant said, "if it makes you feel any better, you're far from the worst case here." It was the first humane gesture the attendant had made toward Luce, and she believed that it was intended to make her feel better. But she'd been sent here because of the suspicious death of the guy she'd been crazy about, and still she was far from the worst case here? Luce wondered what else exactly they were dealing with at Sword and Cross. "Okay, orientation's over," the attendant said. "You're on your own now. Here's a map, if you need to find anything else." She gave Luce a photocopy of a crude, hand-drawn map, then glanced at her watch. "You've got an hour before your first class, but my soaps come on in 5, so..." She waved her hand at Luce. "Make yourself scarce. And don't forget," she said, pointing up at the cameras one last time, "the Reds are watching you." Before Luce could reply, a skinny, dark-haired girl appeared in front of her, wagging her long fingers in Luce's face. "Ooh," the girl taunted in a ghost storytelling voice, dancing around Luce in a circle. "The Reds are watching you." "Get out of here, Arian, before I have you lobotomized," the attendant said, though it was clear from her first brief but genuine smile that she had some coarse affection for the crazy girl. It was also clear that Arian did not reciprocate the love. She mimed a jerking-off motion at the attendant, then stared at Luce, daring her to be offended. "And just for that," the attendant said, jotting a furious note in her book, "you've earned yourself the task of showing Little Miss Sunshine around today." She pointed at Luce, who looked anything but sunny in her black jeans, black boots, and black top. Under the dress code section, the Sword and Cross website had cheerily maintained that as long as the students were on good behavior, they were free to dress as they pleased, with just 2 small stipulations. Style must be modest, and color must be black. Some freedom. The 2 big mock turtleneck Luce's mom had forced on her this morning did nothing for her curves, and even her best feature was gone. Her thick, black hair, which used to hang down to her waist, had been almost completely shorn off. The cabin fire had left her scalp singed and her hairline patchy, so after the long, silent ride home from Dover, Mom had planted Luce in the bathtub, brought out Dad's electric razor, and wordlessly shaved her head. Over the summer, her hair had grown out a little, just enough so that her once enviable waves now hovered in awkward twists just below her ears. Arian sized her up, tapping one finger against her pale lips. "Perfect," she said, stepping forward to loop her arm through Luce's. "I was just thinking I could really use a new slave." The door to the lobby swung open, and in walked the tall kid with green eyes. He shook his head and said to Luce, "This place isn't afraid to do a strip search, so if you're packing any other hazards..." He raised an eyebrow and dumped a handful of unrecognizables in the box. "Save yourself the trouble." Behind Luce, Arian laughed under her breath. The boy's head shot up, and when his eyes registered Arian, he opened his mouth, then closed it, like he was unsure how to proceed. "Arian," he said evenly. "Cam," she returned. "You know him?" Luce whispered, wondering whether there were the same kinds of cliques in reform schools as there were in prep schools, like Dover. "Don't remind me," Arian said, dragging Luce out the door into the gray and swampy morning. The back of the main building led out onto a chipped sidewalk bordering a messy field. The grass was so overgrown it looked more like a vacant lot than a school commons, but a faded scoreboard and a small stack of wooden bleachers argued otherwise. Beyond the commons lay four severe-looking buildings, the cinder-block dormitory on the far left, a huge, old, ugly church on the far right, and two other expansive structures in between that Luce imagined were the classrooms. This was it. Her whole world was reduced to the sorry sight before her eyes. Arion immediately veered right off the path and led Luce to the field, sitting her down on top of one of the waterlogged wooden bleachers. The corresponding setup at Dover had screamed Ivy League jock in training, so Luce had always avoided hanging out there. But this empty field, with its rusted, warped goals, told a very different story, one that wasn't as easy for Luce to figure out. Three turkey vultures swooped overhead, and a dismal wind whipped through the bare branches of the oak trees. Luce ducked her chin down into her mock turtleneck. "So," Arion said, "now you've met Randy."
"I thought his name was Cam."
"We're not talking about him," Arion said quickly. "I mean She-Man in there." Arion jerked her head toward the office where they'd left the attendant in front of the TV. "What do you think, dude or chick?"
Chick?"
Luce said tentatively. "Is this a test?" Arion cracked a smile. "The first of many. And you passed. At least, I think you passed. The gender of most of the faculty here is an ongoing, school-wide debate. Don't worry, you'll get into it." Luce thought Arion was making a joke, in which case, cool. But this was all such a huge change from Dover. At her old school, the green tie-wearing, pomaded future senators had practically oozed through the halls in the genteel hush that money seemed to lay over everything. More often than not, the other Dover kids gave Luce a don't-smudge-the-white-walls-with-your-fingerprints sideways glance. She tried to imagine Arion there, lazing on the bleachers, making a loud, crude joke in her peppery voice. Luce tried to imagine what Callie might think of Arion. There'd been no one like her at Dover. "Okay, spill it," Arion ordered. Plopping down on the top bleacher and motioning for Luce to join her, she said, "What did you do to get in here?" Arian's tone was playful, but suddenly Luce had to sit down. It was ridiculous, but she'd half expected to get through her first day of school without the past creeping up and robbing her of her thin facade of calm. Of course people here were going to want to know. She could feel the blood thrumming at her temples. It happened whenever she tried to think back, really think back, to that night. She'd never stop feeling guilty about what had happened to Trevor, but she also tried really hard not to get mired down in the shadows, which by now were the only things she could remember about the accident. Those dark, indefinable things that she could never tell anyone about. Scratch that, she'd started to tell Trevor about the peculiar presence she'd felt that night, about the twisting shapes hanging over their heads, threatening to mar their perfect evening. Of course, by then, it was already too late. Trevor was gone, his body burned beyond recognition, and Luce was she guilty? No one knew about the murky shapes she sometimes saw in the darkness. They'd always come to her. They'd come and gone for so long that Luce couldn't even remember the first time she'd seen them. But she could remember the first time she realized that the shadows didn't come for everyone, or actually anyone, but her. When she was 7, her family had been on vacation in Hilton Head, and her parents had taken her on a boat trip. It was just about sunset when the shadows started rolling in over the water, and she turned to her father and said, "What do you do when they come, Dad? Why aren't you afraid of the monsters?" There were no monsters, her parents assured her, but Luce's repeated insistence on the presence of something wobbly and dark had gotten her several appointments with a family eye doctor, and then glasses, and then appointments with the ear doctor, after she made the mistake of describing the hoarse, whooshing noise that the shadows sometimes made, and then therapy, and then more therapy, and finally the prescription for antipsychotic medication. But nothing ever made them go away. By the time she was 14, Luce refused to take her meds. That was when they found Dr. Sanford and the Dover School nearby. They flew to New Hampshire, and her father drove their rental car up a long, curved driveway to a hilltop mansion called Shady Hollows. They planted Luce in front of a man in a lab coat and asked her if she still saw her visions. Her parents' palms were sweating as they gripped her hands, brows furrowed with the fear that there was something terribly wrong with their daughter. No one came out and said that if she didn't tell Dr. Sanford what they all wanted her to say, she might be seeing a whole lot more of Shady Hollows. When she lied and acted normal, she was allowed to enroll at Dover and only had to visit Dr. Sanford twice a month. Luce had been permitted to stop taking the horrible pills as soon as she started pretending she didn't see the shadows anymore. But she still had no control over when they might appear. All she knew was that the mental catalog of places where they'd come for her in the past, dense forests, murky waters, became the places she avoided at all costs. All she knew was that when the shadows came, they were usually accompanied by a cold chill under her skin, a sickening feeling unlike anything else. Luce straddled one of the bleachers and gripped her temples between her thumbs and middle fingers. If she was going to make it through today, she had to push her past to the recesses of her mind. She couldn't stand probing the memory of that night by herself, so there was no way she could air all the gruesome details to some weird, maniacal stranger. Instead of answering, she watched Arian, who was lying back on the bleachers, sporting a pair of enormous black sunglasses that covered the better part of her face. It was hard to tell, but she must have been staring at Luce, too, because after a second, she shot up from the bleachers and grinned. "Cut my hair like yours," she said. "What?" Luce gasped. "Your hair is beautiful." It was true. Arian had the long, thick locks that Luce so desperately missed. Her loose black curls sparkled in the sunlight, giving off just a tinge of red. Luce tucked her hair behind her ears, even though it still wasn't long enough to do anything but flop back down in front of them. "Beautiful schmutiful," Arian said. "Yours is sexy, edgy, and I want it."
Okay, Luce said. Was that a compliment?
She didn't know if she was supposed to be flattered or unnerved by the way Arian assumed she could have whatever she wanted, even if what she wanted belonged to someone else.
"Where are we going to get..."
"Ta-da!" Arian reached into her bag and pulled out the pink Swiss Army knife Gabby had tossed into the hazard box.
"What?" she said, seeing Luce's reaction.
"I always bring my sticky fingers on new student drop-off days. The idea alone gets me through the dog days of sword and cross internment, summer camp."
"You spent the whole summer here?" Luce winced.
"Ha!" Spoken like a true newbie. "You're probably expecting a spring break." She tossed Luce the Swiss Army knife. "We don't get to leave this hellhole. Ever. Now cut."
"What about the Reds?" Luce asked, glancing around with the knife in her hand. "There were bound to be cameras somewhere out here."
Arian shook her head. "I refuse to associate with pansies. Can you handle it or not?" Luce nodded.
"And don't tell me you've never cut hair before."
Arian grabbed the Swiss Army knife back from Luce, pulled out the scissor tool, and handed it back. "Not another word until you tell me how fantastic I look." In the salon of her parents' bathtub, Luce's mother had tugged the remains of her long hair into a messy ponytail before lopping the whole thing off. Luce was sure there had to be a more strategic method of cutting hair, but as a lifelong haircut avoider, the chopped-off pony was about all she knew. She gathered Arian's hair in her hands, wrapped an elastic band from her wrist around it, held the small scissors firmly, and began to hack. The ponytail fell to her feet, and Arian gasped and whipped around. She picked it up and held it to the sun. Luce's heart constricted at the sight. She still agonized over her own lost hair and all the other losses it symbolized. But Arian just let a thin smile spread across her lips. She ran her fingers through the ponytail once, then dropped it into her bag. "Awesome," she said. "Keep going."
"Arian," Luce whispered before she could stop herself. "Your neck, it's all..."
"Scarred," Arian finished. "You can say it." The skin on Arian's neck, from the back of her left ear all the way down to her collarbone, was jagged and marbled and shiny. Luce's mind went to Trevor, to those awful pictures. Even her own parents wouldn't look at her after they saw them. She was having a hard time looking at Arian now. Arian grabbed Luce's hand and pressed it to the skin. It was hot and cold at the same time. It was smooth and rough.
"I'm not afraid of it," Arian said. "Are you?"
"No," Luce said, though she wished Arian would take her hand away so Luce could take hers away, too. Her stomach churned as she wondered whether this was how Trevor's skin would have felt. "Are you afraid of who you really are, Luce?"
"No," Luce said again, quickly. It must be so obvious that she was lying.
She closed her eyes. All she wanted from Sword and Cross was a fresh start, a place where people didn't look at her the way Arian was looking at her right now. At the school's gates that morning, when her father had whispered the Price family motto in her ear, "Prices never crash," it had felt possible, but already Luce felt so run down and exposed. She tugged her hand away.
"So how'd it happen?" she asked, looking down.
"Remember how I didn't press you when you clammed up about what you did to get here?" Arian asked, raising her eyebrows. Luce nodded. Arian gestured to the scissors.
"Touch it up in the back, okay? Make me look real pretty. Make me look like you."
Even with the same exact cut, Arian would still only look like a very undernourished version of Luce. While Luce attempted to even out the first haircut she'd ever given, Arian delved into the complexities of life at Sword and Cross.
"That cell block over there is Augustine. It's where we have our so-called social events on Wednesday nights, and all of our classes," she said, pointing at a building the color of yellowed teeth, two buildings to the right of the dorm. It looked like it had been designed by the same sadist who'd done Pauline. It was dismally square, dismally fortress-like, fortified by the same barbed wire and barred windows. An unnatural-looking gray mist cloaked the walls like moss, making it impossible to see whether anyone was over there.
"Fair warning," Arian continued. "You're going to hate the classes here. You wouldn't be human if you didn't."
"Why? What's so bad about them?" Luce asked. Maybe Arian just didn't like school in general. With her black nail polish, black eyeliner, and the black bag that only seemed big enough to hold her new Swiss Army knife, she didn't exactly look bookish.
"The classes here are soulless," Arian said.
"Worse, they'll strip you of your soul. Of the 80 kids in this place, I'd say we've only got about 3 remaining souls." She glanced up. "Unspoken for, anyway."
That didn't sound promising, but Luce was hung up on another part of Arian's answer.
"Wait, there are only 80 kids in this whole school?"
The summer before she went to Dover, Luce had pored over the thick prospective student's handbook, memorizing all the statistics. But everything she'd learned so far about Sword and Cross had surprised her, making her realize that she was coming into reform school completely unprepared. Arian nodded, making Luce accidentally snip off a chunk of hair she'd meant to leave.
Whoops.
Hopefully Arian wouldn't notice, or maybe she'd just think it was edgy.
8 classes, 10 kids, a pop. You get to know everybody's crap pretty quickly," Arian said,
"and vice versa." I guess so, Luce agreed, biting her lip. Arion was joking, but Luce wondered whether she'd be sitting here with that cool smirk and her pastel blue eyes if she knew the exact nature of Luce's backstory. The longer Luce could keep her past under wraps, the better off she'd be.
And you'll want to steer clear of the hard cases.
Hard cases?
The kids with the wristband tracking devices, Arion said. About a third of the student body.
And they're the ones who...
You don't want to mess with, trust me.
Well, what did they do? Luce asked. As much as Luce wanted to keep her own story a secret, she didn't like the way Arion was treating her like some sort of ingenue. Whatever those kids had done couldn't be much worse than what everyone told her she had done. Or could it? After all, she knew next to nothing about these people and this place. The possibility stirred up a cold, gray fear in the pit of her stomach.
Oh, you know, Arion drawled. Aided and abetted terrorist acts, chopped up their parents and roasted them on a spit.
She turned around to wink at Luce.
Shut up, Luce said. I'm serious. Those psychos are under much tighter restrictions than the rest of the screw-ups here. We call them the Shackled.
Luce laughed at Arion's dramatic tone. Your haircut's done, she said, running her hands through Arion's hair to fluff it up a little. It actually looked really cool.
Sweet, Arion said.
She turned to face Luce. When she ran her fingers through her hair, the sleeves of her black sweater fell back on her forearms, and Luce caught a glimpse of a black wristband, dotted with rows of silver studs, and on the other wrist, another band that looked more... mechanical. Arion caught her looking and raised her eyebrows devilishly.
Told ya, she said. Total effing psychos.
She grinned.
Come on, I'll give you the rest of the tour.
Luce didn't have much choice. She scrambled down the bleachers after Arion, ducking when one of the turkey vultures swooped dangerously low. Arion, who didn't seem to notice, pointed at a lichen-swathed church at the far right of the commons.
Over here you'll find our state-of-the-art gymnasium, she said, assuming a nasal tour guide tone of voice. Yes, yes, to the untrained eye it looks like a church.
It used to be. We're kind of in an architectural hand-me-down hell here at Sword and Cross. A few years ago some calisthenic-crazed shrink showed up, ranting about over-medicated teens ruining society. He donated a shit-ton of money so they'd convert it into a gym. Now the powers that be think we can work out our frustrations in a more natural and productive way. Luce groaned. She'd always loathed gym class.
Girl after my very own heart, Arion commiserated. Coach Deontay is evil.
As Luce jogged to keep up, she took in the rest of the grounds. The Dover quad had been so well kept, all manicured and dotted with evenly spaced, carefully pruned trees. Sword and Cross looked like it had been plopped down and abandoned in the middle of a swamp. Weeping willows dangled to the ground, kudzu grew along the walls in sheets, and every third step they took squished. And it wasn't just the way the place looked. Every humid breath Luce took stuck in her lungs. Just breathing at Sword and Cross made her feel like she was sinking into quicksand.
Apparently the architects got in a huge standoff over how to retrofit the style of the old military academy buildings. The upshot is we ended up with half penitentiary, half medieval torture zone. And no gardener, Arion said, kicking some slime off her combat boots.
Gross!
Oh, and there's the cemetery.
Luce followed Arion's pointing finger to the far left side of the quad, just past the dormitory. An even thicker cloak of mist hung over the walled-off portion of land. It was bordered on three sides by a thick forest of oaks. She couldn't see into the cemetery, which seemed almost to sink below the surface of the ground, but she could smell the rot and hear the chorus of cicadas buzzing in the trees. For a second, she thought she saw the dark swish of the shadows, but she blinked, and they were gone.
That's a cemetery?
Yep. This used to be a military academy way back in the Civil War days, so that's where they buried all their dead. It's creepy as all get out. And Lord, Arian said, piling on a fake southern accent, it stinks to high heaven.
Then she winked at Luce. We hang out there a lot.
Luce looked at Arian to see if she was kidding. Arian just shrugged.
Okay, it was only once, and it was only after a really big pharmapalooza.
Now, that was a word Luce recognized.
Aha, Arian laughed. I just saw a light go on up there, so somebody is home.
Well, Luce, my dear, you may have gone to boarding school parties, but you've never seen a throwdown like reform school kids do it.
What's the difference? Luce asked, trying to skirt the fact that she'd never actually been to a big party at Dover.
You'll see. Arian paused and turned to Luce. You'll come over tonight and hang out, okay?
She surprised Luce by taking her hand.
Promise?
But I thought you said I should stay away from the hard cases, Luce joked.
Rule number two, don't listen to me, Arian laughed, shaking her head. I'm certifiably insane.
She started jogging again, and Luce trailed after her.
Wait, what was rule number one?
Keep up.
As they came around the corner of the cinder block classrooms, Arian skidded to a halt.
Effect cool, she said.
Cool, Luce repeated. All the other students seemed to be clustered around the kudzu strangled trees outside Augustine. No one looked exactly happy to be hanging out, but no one looked ready to go inside yet, either. There hadn't been much of a dress code at Dover, so Luce wasn't used to the uniformity it gave a student body. Then again, even though every kid here was wearing the same black jeans, black mock turtleneck t-shirt, and black sweater tied over the shoulders or around the waist, there were still substantial differences in the way they pulled it off. A group of tattooed girls standing in a crossed-armed circle wore bangle bracelets up to their elbows. The black bandanas in their hair reminded Luce of a film she'd once seen about motorcycle gang girls. She'd rented it because she'd thought, what could be cooler than an all-girls motorcycle gang? Now Luce's eyes locked with those of one of the girls across the lawn. The sideways squint of the girl's darkly lined cat eyes made Luce quickly shift the direction of her gaze. A guy and a girl who were holding hands had sewn sequins in the shape of skulls and crossbones on the back of their black sweaters. Every few seconds, one of them would pull the other in for a kiss on the temple, on the earlobe, on the eye. When they looped their arms around each other, Luce could see that each wore the blinking wristband tracking device. They looked a little rough, but it was obvious how much in love they were. Every time she saw their tongue rings flashing, Luce felt a lonely pinch inside her chest. Behind the lovers, a cluster of blonde boys stood pressed against the wall. Each of them wore his sweater, despite the heat. And they all had on white Oxford shirts underneath, the collars starched straight up. Their black pants hit the vamps of their polished dress shoes perfectly. Of all the students on the quad, these boys seemed to Luce to be the closest thing to Doverites. But a closer look quickly set them apart from boys she used to know, boys like Trevor. Just standing in a group, these guys radiated a specific kind of toughness. It was right there in the look in their eyes. It was hard to explain, but it suddenly struck Luce that just like her, everyone at this school had a past. Everyone here probably had secrets they wouldn't want to share. But she couldn't figure out whether this realization made her feel more or less isolated. Arian noticed Luce's eyes running over the rest of the kids. We all do what we can to make it through the day, she said, shrugging. But in case you hadn't observed the low-hanging vultures, this place pretty much reeks of death. She took a seat on a bench under a weeping willow and patted the spot next to her for Luce. Luce wiped away a mound of wet, decaying leaves, but just before she sat down, she noticed another dress code violation. A very attractive dress code violation. He wore a bright red scarf around his neck. It was far from cold outside, but he had on a black leather motorcycle jacket over his black sweater, too. Maybe it was because his was the only spot of color on the quad, but he was all that Luce could look at. In fact, everything else so paled in comparison that, for one long moment, Luce forgot where she was. She took in his deep golden hair and matching tan, his high cheekbones, the dark sunglasses that covered his eyes, the soft shape of his lips. In all the movies Luce had seen, and in all the books she'd read, the love interest was mind-blowingly good-looking, except for that one little flaw. The chipped tooth, the charming cowlick, the beauty mark on his left cheek. She knew why. If the hero was too unblemished, he'd risk being unapproachable. But approachable or not, Luce had always had a weakness for the sublimely gorgeous. Like this guy. He leaned up against the building with his arms crossed lightly over his chest. And for a split second, Luce saw a flashing image of herself folded into those arms. She shook her head, but the vision stayed so clear that she almost took off toward him. No, that was crazy. Right? Even at a school full of crazies, Luce was well aware that this instinct was insane. She didn't even know him. He was talking to a shorter kid with dreads and a toothy smile. Both of them were laughing hard and genuinely, in a way that made Luce strangely jealous. She tried to think back and remember how long it had been since she'd laughed, really laughed, like that. "That's Daniel Grigori," Arian said, leaning in and reading her mind. "I can tell he's attracted somebody's attention." "Understatement," Luce agreed, embarrassed when she realized how she must have looked to Arian. "Yeah, well, if you like that sort of thing." "What's not to like?" Luce said, unable to stop the words from tumbling out. "His friend there is Roland," Arian said, nodding in the dreadlocked kid's direction. "He's cool. The kind of guy who can get his hands on things, you know." "Not really," Luce thought, biting her lip. "What kinds of things?" Arian shrugged, using her poached Swiss Army knife to saw off a fraying strand from a rip in her black jeans. "Just things. Ask and you shall receive kind of stuff." "What about Daniel?" Luce asked. "What's his story?" "Oh, she doesn't give up," Arian laughed, then cleared her throat. "No one really knows," she said. "He holds pretty tight to his mystery man persona. Could just be your typical reform school asshole." "I'm no stranger to assholes," Luce said, though as soon as the words came out, she wished she could take them back. After what had happened to Trevor, whatever had happened, she was the last person who should be making character judgments. But more than that, the rare time she made even the smallest reference to that night, the shifting black canopy of the shadows came back to her, almost like she was right back at the lake. She glanced again at Daniel. He took his glasses off and slid them inside his jacket, then turned to look at her. His gaze caught hers, and Luce watched as his eyes widened and then quickly narrowed in what looked like surprise. But no, it was more than that. When Daniel's eyes held hers, her breath caught in her throat. She recognized him from somewhere. But she would have remembered meeting someone like him. She would have remembered feeling as absolutely shaken up as she did right now. She realized they were still locking eyes when Daniel flashed her a smile. A jet of warmth shot through her, and she had to grip the bench for support. She felt her lips pull up in a smile back at him, but then he raised his hand in the air and flipped her off. Luce gasped and dropped her eyes. "What?" Arian asked, oblivious to what had just gone down. "Never mind," she said. "We don't have time. I sense the bell." The bell rang as if on cue, and the whole student body started the slow shuffle into the building. Arian was tugging on Luce's hand and spouting off directions about where to meet her next and when. But Luce was still reeling from being flipped the bird by such a perfect stranger. Her momentary delirium over Daniel had vanished, and now the only thing she wanted to know was, what was that guy's problem? Just before she ducked into her first class, she dared to glance back. His face was blank, but there was no mistaking it. He was watching her go.
2. Fit to be tied. Luce had a piece of paper with her schedule printed on it, a half-empty notebook she'd started to fill at Dover in her advanced European history class last year, 2 number 2 pencils, her favorite eraser, and the sudden bad feeling that Arian might have been right about the classes at Sword and Cross. The teacher had yet to materialize. The flimsy desks were arranged in haphazard rows, and the supply closet was barricaded with stacks of dusty boxes piled in front of it. What was worse, none of the other kids seemed to notice the disarray. In fact, none of the other kids seemed to notice that they were in a classroom at all. They all stood clustered near the windows, taking one last drag of a cigarette here, repositioning the extra-large safety pins on their T-shirts there. Only Todd was seated at an actual desk, carving something intricate onto its surface with his pen. But the other new students seemed to have already found their places among the crowd. Cam had the preppy Dover-looking guys in a tight cluster around him. They must have been friends when he was enrolled at Sword and Cross the first time. Gabby was shaking hands with a tongue-pierced girl who'd been making out with a tongue-pierced guy outside. Luce felt stupidly envious that she wasn't daring enough to do anything but take a seat closer to the unthreatening Todd. Arian flitted about the others, whispering things Luce couldn't make out, like some sort of goth princess. When she passed Cam, he tousled her newly chopped hair.
"Nice mop, Arian."
He smirked, tugging on a strand at the back of her neck.
"My compliments to your stylist."
Arian swatted him away.
"Hands off, Cam, which is to say, in your dreams."
She jerked her head in Luce's direction.
"And you can give your compliments to my new pet, right over there."
Cam's emerald eyes sparkled at Luce, who stiffened.
"I believe I will," he said, and started walking toward her.
He smiled at Luce, who was sitting with her ankles crossed under her chair and her hands folded neatly on her heavily graffitied desk.
"Us new kids have to stick together," he said. "Know what I mean?"
"But I thought you'd been here before."
"Don't believe everything Arian says."
He glanced back at Arian, who was standing at the window, eyeing them suspiciously.
"Oh, no, she didn't say anything about you," Luce said quickly, trying to remember whether or not that was actually true. It was clear Cam and Arian didn't like each other, and even though Luce was grateful to Arian for taking her around this morning, she wasn't ready to pick any sides yet.
"I remember when I was a new kid here, the first time."
He laughed to himself.
"My band had just broken up and I was lost. I didn't know anyone. I could have used someone without..."
He glanced at Arian.
"An agenda to show me the ropes."
"What, and you have no agenda?" Luce said, surprised to hear a flirting lilt in her voice.
An easy smile spread across Cam's face. He raised one eyebrow at her.
"And to think I didn't want to come back here."
Luce blushed. She didn't usually get involved with rocker guys, but then again, none of them had ever pulled the desk next to her even closer, plopped down beside her, and stared at her with eyes quite so green. Cam reached into his pocket and pulled out a green guitar pick with the number 44 printed on it.
"This is my room number. Come by any time."
The guitar pick wasn't far from the color of Cam's eyes, and Luce wondered how and when he'd had these printed up. But before she could answer, and who knew what she would have answered, Arian clamped a hard hand down on Cam's shoulder.
"I'm sorry, did I not make myself clear? I've already called dibs on this one."
Cam snorted. He looked straight at Luce as he said,
"See, I thought there was still such a thing as free will. Maybe your pet has a path of her own in mind."
Luce opened her mouth to claim that of course she had a path. It was just her first day here, and she was still figuring out the ropes.
But by the time she was able to get the words straight in her head, the minute warning bell rang, and the little gathering over Luce's desk dissolved. The other kids filed into desks around her, and soon it stopped being so noteworthy that Luce was sitting prim and proper at her desk, keeping her eye on the door, keeping a lookout for Daniel. Out of the corner of her eye, she could feel Cam sneaking peeks at her. She felt flattered and nervous, then frustrated with herself. Daniel? Cam? She'd been in the school for, what, 45 minutes, and her mind was already juggling two different guys. The whole reason she was at this school at all was because the last time she'd been interested in a guy, things had gone horribly, horribly wrong. She should not be allowing herself to get all smitten, twice, on her very first day of school. She looked over at Cam, who winked at her again, then brushed his dark hair away from his eyes. Staggering good looks aside, yeah, right, he really did seem like a useful person to know. Like her, he was still adjusting to the setting, but had clearly been around the sword and cross block a few times before. And he was nice to her. She thought about the green guitar pick with his room number, hoping he didn't give those out freely. They could be friends. Maybe that was all she needed. Maybe then she would stop feeling quite so obviously out of place at Sword and Cross. Maybe then she'd be able to forgive the fact that the only window in the classroom was the size of a business envelope, caked with lime, and looked out on a massive mausoleum in the cemetery. Maybe then she'd be able to forget the nose-tickling odor of peroxide emanating from the bleached blonde punk chick sitting in front of her. Maybe then she could actually pay attention to the stern, mustached teacher who marched into the room, commanded the class to shape up and sit down, and firmly closed the door. The smallest tweak of disappointment tugged at her heart. It took her a moment to trace where it had come from. Disappointment tugged at her heart. It took her a moment to trace where it had come from. Until the teacher shut the door, she'd been holding out a little hope that Daniel would be in her first class, too. What did she have next hour? French? She looked down at her schedule to check what room it was in. Just then, a paper airplane skidded across her schedule, overshot her desk, and landed on the floor by her bag. She checked to see who'd noticed, but the teacher was busy tearing through a piece of chalk as he wrote something on the board. Luce glanced nervously to her left. When Cam looked over at her, he gave her a wink and a flirty little wave that caused her whole body to tense up. But he didn't seem to have seen or been responsible for the paper airplane. "Psst," came the quiet whisper behind him. It was Arian, who motioned with her chin for Luce to pick up the paper plane. Luce bent down to reach for it and saw her name written in small black letters on the wing. Her first note. "Already looking for the exit? Not a good sign. We're in this hellhole until lunch." That had to be a joke. Luce double-checked her schedule and realized with horror that all three of her morning classes were in this very same room one, and all three would be taught by the very same Mr. Cole. He detached himself from the blackboard and was sleepily threading his way through the room. There was no introduction for the new kids, and Luce couldn't decide whether she was glad about that or not. Mr. Cole merely slapped syllabi down on each of the four new students' desks. When the stapled packet landed in front of Luce, she leaned forward eagerly to take a look. "History of the World," it read, "Circumventing the Doom of Mankind." History had always been her strongest subject, but circumventing doom? A closer look at the syllabus was all it took for Luce to see that Arian had been right about being in a hellhole. An impossible reading load, test, in big bold letters every third class period, and a 30-page paper on, seriously? The failed tyrant of your choice. Thick black parentheses had been drawn in black Sharpie around the assignments Luce had missed during the first few weeks. In the margins, Mr. Cole had written, "See me for makeup research assignment." If there was a more effective way of soul-sucking, Luce would be scared to find out. At least she had Arion sitting back there in the next row. Luce was glad the precedent had already been set for SOS note passing. She and Callie used to text each other on the sly, but to make it here, Luce was definitely going to need to learn to fold a paper airplane. She tore a sheet from her notebook and tried to use Arion's as a model. After a few origami-challenged minutes, another plane landed on her desk. She glanced back at Arion, who shook her head and gave her a you-have-so-much-to-learn roll of the eyes. Luce shrugged an apology and swiveled back around to open the second note. "Oh, and until you're confident about your aim, you might not want to fly any Daniel-related messages my way. Dude behind you is famous on the football field for his interceptions." Good to know. She hadn't even seen Daniel's friend Roland come in behind her. Now she turned very slightly in her seat until she glimpsed his dreadlocks out of the corner of her eye. She dared a glance down at the open notebook on his desk and caught his full name, Roland Sparks. "No note passing," Mr. Cole said sternly, causing Luce to whip her head back to attention. "No plagiarizing and no looking at one another's papers. I didn't put myself through graduate school only to receive your divided attention." Luce nodded in unison with the other dazed kids, just as a third paper plane glided to a stop in the middle of her desk. "Only 172 minutes to go." 173 torturous minutes later, Arion was leading Luce to the cafeteria. "What'd you think?" she asked. "You were right," Luce said numbly, still recovering from how painfully bleak her first 3 hours of class had been. "Why would anyone teach such a depressing subject?" "Ah, Cole'll ease up soon. He puts on his no-guff face every time there's a new student. Anyway," Arion said, poking Luce, "it could be worse. You could have gotten stuck with Miss Tross." Luce glanced down at her schedule. "I have her for biology in the afternoon block," she said, with a sinking feeling in her gut. As Arion sputtered out a laugh, Luce felt a bump on her shoulder. It was Cam, passing them in the hall on his way to lunch. Luce would have gone sprawling if not for his hand reaching back to steady her. "Easy there." He shot her a quick smile, and she wondered if he had bumped her intentionally. But he didn't seem that juvenile. Luce glanced at Arion to see whether she'd noticed anything. Arion raised her eyebrows, almost inviting Luce to speak, but neither one of them said a thing. When they crossed the dusty interior windows, separating Bleak Hall from Bleaker Cafeteria, Arion took hold of Luce's elbow. "Avoid the chicken-fried steak at all costs," she coached, as they followed the crowd.